But in that truth is something deep and profound. I want to know God. I don't want to just know about God. I don't want to know about religion. I want to know God. I want God to somehow reach into this heart and heal it and give it hope. Maybe challenge it in the right way. Maybe teach it. I want to know that I'm loved, that I'm cared for. I want to know what God thinks about me. Not just what other people on Facebook may or may not think about me. That's kind of depressing sometimes. I want to know what God thinks. I want to feel the presence. So it's both a radical prayer and a comforting prayer. Well, we're not the first ones to want to know that God is there. We're not the first ones to want to experience and feel and touch and walk away changed. We come to the end of really Israel's story and one of the last prophets, a guy by the name of Ezekiel. But sometimes we hear a song like that in this nice, comfortable setting, which is fine. I'm all for comfort when you can get it. But we also need to know that sometimes that song was prayed and sung in uncomfortable times. So let me set it up for you. Imagine that you're in the back of a prison van, and they're driving away from your home. And in the rearview mirror, you see Good Shepherd burning. And you see all that was familiar to you occupied by people that don't look like you, and armies that you didn't ask for. And you see children weeping and mothers crying and fathers yelling, and they're being paraded onto buses, and you're heading off to a land for how long you don't know, to live in a place you've never been before. And that is the image of Ezekiel as he's being carried off, not by his own will, from his beloved city, from Jerusalem. He's the son of a priest. This is his town. He's been in the temple. He's experienced the power of God in a setting like this, where he sung songs many times and felt God's presence at the altar. But now all that's gone and burned down by their enemies. How many of you have heard the song, "Bye, bye, Missa"? See, oh, we've got a whole new choir. But on that same album that Don McLean published was this song. It goes like this. Down by the waters of Babylon, we lay down and wept and wept for thee, Zion. We remember, we remember, we remember thee, Zion. He drew those words from Psalm 137, which was written to describe the experience of what you saw in the rearview mirror. Let me read for you Psalm 137. I just want to warn you, this is one of the darker corners of the Bible. This is an honest prayer. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps. There our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How can we sing the songs of the Lord while we're in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Remember, Lord, what the enemies did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction. Happy is the one who repays our enemies according to what they have done to us. Happy is the one who seizes their infants and dashes them against the rocks. That's a pretty dark prayer. Have you ever had an enemy that you hated that much? Don't raise your hands. If you haven't, God bless you. That's good. Because there's nothing good about that kind of hurt and that kind of pain. But it has existed for some people. If you look out in our world today and you think that the angry folks on whatever side of the issue they're angry about, if you think they're wrong, you maybe haven't entered into their life. And this is a heartfelt prayer as you're driving away, looking in the rearview mirror saying, Lord, where are you? Because our enemies have won. And I can't wait for the day when even their babies died because that's what they did to ours. That's hard stuff, friends. And it's out of that the prophet Ezekiel is called. Let me take you to a place in Scripture that describes that call. This is a strange passage, but it's intended to bring hope. Here's Ezekiel. In my 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day, that's pretty specific. Do you have days in your life that you can remember like it was yesterday? We have days in our lives that we wish had never happened, and we have days in our lives that we wish would never go away. Well, this is one of those days that maybe is a little bit of both for Ezekiel. On that fifth day, while I was among the exiles, the prisoners by the Kabar River, the heavens were opened, and I saw a vision of God. So he's in the worst spot of his life, and God shows up and gives him this amazing vision. Listen to this, though. On the fifth of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile from King Jehoiakim, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, by the Kabar River in the land of the Babylonians. To place that on a Google map for you, this is right outside of Baghdad, Iraq. There the hand of the Lord was on him. I looked, and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was human, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, their feet were like those of a calf and gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings on the four sides, they had human hands. All four of them had faces and wings. And the wings of one touched the wings of another. Each one went straight down and did not turn as they moved. Pretty weird. Ever seen anything like it? Me either. You've never seen God either. And that's the point. God doesn't fit in a nice, easy category, in a nice box. Right when I think, yep, that's where God fits. Wait, he's not there. And so Ezekiel needs to be reminded that God is bigger, deeper, more majestic, more mysterious than anything he's experiencing. And that God is still with him, even in a foreign land, even in a dark place. And then it keeps going, and I would encourage you to read more of this vision because there's something about you reading it for yourself and slowing down and just trying to ponder what this looks like. But let me finish. This is how the vision finishes. Then there came a voice from above the vault over the heads of this strange vision. Above the vault, over their heads, was what looked like the throne. And high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man. And I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire. And that from there down, he looked like fire. And brilliant light surrounded him, like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the radiance around him. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of one speaking. He said to me, Son of man, stand up on your feet, and I will speak to you. As he spoke, the Spirit came into me and raised me to my feet. And I heard him speaking to me. And then God gives Ezekiel, through the voice of this strange image, his call to bring comfort and challenge to the people of Israel who now lived in a strange land. And if it's hard to envision, I brought something that hopefully somewhere today you can take a look at that might help you. This hangs in my office on the back wall. It's a gift that was given to me when I graduated from seminary. And it's my wife's cousin's husband, who's a graphic artist, and he read this passage and one just like it in Revelation. And then with colored pencil, he tried to draw it. And the only place he said, I can't get quite dense enough with the pencil, was the white of the vision of the man on the cross. Because that's how John fills it in Revelation. And so here's that vision that I just read for you, visually depicted. And every time I walk into my office, I remember that I serve someone who is mysterious and bigger than me and different than me. And right when I think I've got it all figured out, God says, well, there's more that you need to learn, more that you need to grow into, and I'm bigger than you, and more powerful, and more wonderful, and more holy, and more tender, and more loving, and more merciful. And that's good because you need me for all those things in your life. So maybe later when you come up for communion or before you leave today, go ahead and take a look. Hopefully that puts it into some perspective for you. Strange visions, strange symbols. Let's do something real quick that maybe will help you because I find that a lot of Christians, when they read these symbolic texts in the Bible, we kind of go, okay, let's get to the good part. Let's get past this. Let's get to the teaching of Jesus, the practical stuff, the stuff that helps me tomorrow. But we need this on a little bit of a deeper level. How many of you have a wallet with you? Don't worry, I won't take it from you. Just pull it out. How many of you have one of these? How many of you have too many of these? No, don't raise your hand. How many of you have too much chart? No, don't raise your hand again. It's kind of hard to function in our society without one of these. I mean, have you ever tried to just live on cash? I mean, here, these green things. Have you ever tried to just live on these cash dollars? I keep some around for the occasion when I might need it, but pretty much our society, at least in the United States, at least in most urban areas, it's so much easier to just kind of fly through life with one of these. Matter of fact, if I needed to, I could just pare down to my driver's license and one of these, and I'd probably be pretty good. Just don't take my smartphone, though. What is this, literally? It's a piece of plastic worth less than a few pennies. That's what it literally is. But symbolically, oh, it speaks to a vast network of credit and banking and institutions and the flow of money. And it represents a stability and a trust and the ability for easy access and the ability to share and move assets. And it's just really literally a few pennies worth of plastic. But the symbol is much more powerful than the literal. And so Ezekiel needs something more than the literal. God loves you, don't worry. Have you ever heard God loves you, don't worry, and you thought, I need more? Well, God gives him more. God shows up in the middle of this dust storm and speaks. Why? Because that cuts around all the logic, all the weirdness, all the assumptions about what God might look like or speak like. And it cuts right to the heart. And now Ezekiel finds himself listening and tender. There's another part of this call, though it's very relevant, because it says that he was sitting by the Kabar River. And for the Jewish people, for Ezekiel, the Kabar River represented disaster. Once they crossed that river, they were gone. They were not in Kansas anymore. They were in a different land, and they had to figure out how to live. And every time they'd look at the Kabar River, they'd say, that was the day that God failed. That was the day that I stopped praying. That was the day that I gave up hope. And so it's right there on that place where God says, I know that your people have given up hope. So let me show up in your hopelessness. Let me reread the opening chapter of Ezekiel for you. On the 25th day of the 12th month of my 40th year, I opened my pay envelope and it had a pink slip in it, and I watched my career go down in smoke. On the 27th day of the 10th month of the 26th year of my life, I got a report from the doctor that said he couldn't hear the heartbeat anymore, and I lost the baby. On the 67th year, in my fourth month, on the 12th day, the doctor called me back and said, I found a spot that we should talk about. Can you come in? No, let's not wait till next week. Let's talk sooner. That's, everyone has a K-bar river. We get to the place where we think, what do I do now? And that's where God shows up in Ezekiel's pain and darkness. And that's the place where I cling and I say, I sometimes have those days when I need hope. How many of you have a K-bar river moment? Or maybe how many of you don't? How many of you have a list? Like, Pastor Glenn, I got a lot of rivers in my life. But that's opening the eyes of my heart to say, this is 2,700 years ago, but it's relevant and real. I don't know about you, but sometimes I show up as a pastor and I realize a person needs even way more than me. A person needs God. I remember once when I was in seminary and I had to go through this thing called clinical pastoral education, where you spend 12 months going through hospital, 20 hours a week, and you go through all the psych ward, the birth ward, the emergency room, the surgery ward. And I didn't want to do that. I said, I don't want to be a chaplain. I want to be a pastor. What do I have to do this for? And they said, it's not about you learning to be a chaplain. It's learning about all the junk that you bring. And I thought, oh, boy, that's what I need, 12 months of staring at my navel and learning about my own junk. I don't need that. But I did. And we used to have to do these things where we'd go into people's rooms, and we'd come back and we'd type up what was called a verbatim. And it literally said, I walked in at 12:17 into the patient's room, and the lights were on, and I said, she said, he said, doctor said, and you wrote it up like it was a screenplay. And then you went back once a week to your peer group, and you had to pick people to act out the scene, only you stepped out of it. Oh, that's weird to see yourself acted out by someone else. And one day, I had gone into a 44, 45-year-old woman's room, and she'd just been told that she had stage 4 terminal cancer to get her affairs in order. And I said something deeply pastoral and profound like, it'll be okay. I didn't know what I didn't know, but I needed to know that I didn't know it. And so I came back and wrote up whatever I had said. And my peer group acted it out. And right when I got to the spot where I had said this deeply profound thing, the supervisor said, time out. He said, Glenn, what part of stage 4 cancer is gonna be all right? And I just started to cry. I could feel it now. I can go back to that moment. But he said, you need to learn that sometimes you don't have to say anything. He said, Glenn, you're not God. You know that, right? And I needed to be reminded of that. But he said, sometimes people just need the presence. Maybe you could just go in and say, hello. Can I just sit with you? And so then he assigned me to be the facilitator of the cancer support group for the rest of the year. But it was really one of the most profound experiences I've ever had. And if I'm any good at all about being a pastor, it's because of that. Because I found out that people who have cancer are still people. And one woman said to me, Glenn, I'm not cancer. I'm a human being and I have cancer. But I still want to talk about the Cubs and the weather and my grandkids and all, because I'm human. And so Ezekiel has this need for a human moment and a divine moment all at once. And God gives it to him. And he's also a prophet in this long line of people that God sends to his leaders, political leaders, religious leaders. And he says, bring this message to them. Tell them to turn direction because they're wrong. And they're leading the people in wrong ways. And they do, and it doesn't work. That's the profound aha of the prophets. none of them are listened to. Some of them are killed. That's a tough calling. I don't know if I want that job description. Thank you very much. But our world is better off because of people like William Wilberforce, who worked for 40-plus years to end the slave trade in Britain, and people like Sojourner Truth, and people like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who wrote from a gulag in the former Soviet Union, and people like Susan B. Anthony and Martin Luther King Jr. and Mother Teresa and Nelson Mandela, and the list goes on about people who said, hey, something's not right. This is not the way God created us, and we need to hear that voice. But it's really tough to be that person. Another thing that Ezekiel gives us is the designation or the title Son of Man. The term Son of Man is used 107 times in the Old Testament. 94 of them are in Ezekiel. Kind of important to him. Guess what Jesus' favorite self-designation was? Son of Man. And it means something profound, Son of Man, Son of God, something divine and human. It's a category that's new, that can't be quite fit into any one of the pre-existing categories, because Ezekiel uses it to describe this vision of the man in this ball of flame and holiness. And what Ezekiel is seeing is an early vision of the Lord Jesus Christ. One day, God himself is going to walk in your neighborhood. He's going to show up and talk and teach and live and hang out and do life. And he's going to bring holiness right next door. He's going to get into your calendar and get into your life and into your friendships. And one day, stay hopeful, Ezekiel. Stay hopeful, because the God that you see holy and high and lifted up will come and be with you. And he does in the Lord Jesus Christ. Let me read to you one of Jesus' last sermons. This is Jesus' words from Matthew chapter 25. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, Jesus is talking about himself. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. Smack out of the vision of Ezekiel several hundred years before. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Right out of Ezekiel's vision. Then the king will say to those on his right, come now, you who are blessed by my Father. Take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. There's something very divine and very human about that. Jesus tells us he's the Son of Man who will come in glory with the angels and sit on a throne and then celebrate all the human moments that we've had with one another. When we were tender to the least of these, when we reached out to people falling through the cracks, Jesus will say, that's when I was with you before I got here on my throne. Wow. Who knew? Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? And the king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. Wow. But then he's a true king, and he's a true judge, and in the truth of the prophetic voice of Ezekiel, he says, then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty. You gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger. You didn't invite me in. I needed clothes and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison. You did not look after me. They also will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and did not help you? He will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. And Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man, going back to Ezekiel's vision. And Ezekiel has this wonderful, strange, terrible, uplifting, sometimes depressing life because he's going back and forth with these images, but the reality of his life is still the same. He's still in a country that he didn't want to be in. And God gives him a vision of the throne in heaven. The Apostle John must have had that scroll open when he wrote the book of Revelation, because the book of Revelation turns on the vision of the throne in Revelation 4 and 5. I need to see God on the throne. How many of you sometimes question whether God is really on the throne? No, don't raise your hands. I'm just saying, I do. Sometimes I read the paper and say, okay, this would be a good time to show up. Like now. Cue the angels. I mean, I'm being honest with you. And then there are other times when God's presence is so unmistakable, I can't even speak. There are times when I think, I can't tell you what just happened, but God just moved through this place, or through this group, or through this meeting, or through this prayer, or through this communion. And that's human life, and Ezekiel goes through all of that. God gives him a vision of a new temple. He says, I know the old one got knocked down, but there's a new one coming, which must have just drove Ezekiel crazy and filled him with great hope because the temple is the temple. I mean, it's the place. It's the place where Yahweh dwells. He gave Ezekiel a vision of these strange beasts called Gog and Magog and all the nations in turmoil at the end of the world. Again, the Apostle John drawing on those for the book of Revelation. He gave Ezekiel a vision of a watchman, that anyone who would follow Jesus Christ needs to be like a watchman standing on the fence, watching and saying, wait a second, not that way, this way. And then he gave Ezekiel this vision of the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherd. That's our metaphor here. Good Shepherd. Good Shepherd. He's good because he speaks the truth, but in a way that still draws me to him. When I hear the truth from Jesus, I still want to be with him. I don't always want to hear that truth, but I want to be with him because I know he's going to say, and here is how to move away from that pain. Here's how to move through that suffering. Here's how to get rid of that temptation. That's what Jesus does for me. And he gave Ezekiel this vision of what the Jewish people would call the Kavod Yahweh. Let's all learn a little Hebrew. Ready? Say it with me. The Kavod Yahweh. Now you got to say it. Ready? One, two, three. The Kavod Yahweh. That's known as the Shekinah or Shekinah glory of God. It's the ineffable that you can't quite explain. It's more mysterious than what happens in nanotechnology or the fusion of a cell or in nuclear physics or in quantum mechanics. It is the essence of God, the beauty of God, the difference of God, the holiness of God, all bundled all at once. And if you're touched by it, you will never be the same. And God shows up and gives Ezekiel this little bitty just. And so Ezekiel keeps marching on. I pray that all of you have a taste of the Shekinah glory of God. I can't bring it. I can't create a service in which that happens. Only God can decide when God shows up in that way. But he did for Ezekiel. And the glory of the Lord lived then in Ezekiel's heart, mind, soul, and body. And because of that, he was able to continue. There's a powerful thing that happens. As I finish this message, I want you to think about this. If you could ask God for one thing right now, just one thing, what would it be? I mean, I have more than one thing on my list, but I'm just saying, what would be that one thing if God showed up and said, What would you ask of me, my daughter, my son? What would be that one thing? How would you pray? Because we're going to end this service with praying some of those prayers. Let me finish this by this reflection. Ezekiel comes to another place where he's really tired and weary. And he's like, Lord, I've been doing this a long time. What good's it doing? How's it helping? And then God says this to him. The hand of the Lord was on me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were dry. And he asked me, Son of man, can these bones live? Be careful when God asks you a question. Ezekiel said, good answer here too. I said, Sovereign Lord, you alone know. Then the Lord said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come back to life. I will attach tendons to you, make flesh come upon you, and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you, and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am Lord. And the word he uses there for breath is the Hebrew word ruah. Ready? Here we go. 1, 2, 3. That's the word for spirit. The Greek word for spirit is pneuma. We get our word pneumatic from that. Have you ever gone to the gas station and they change your tire and you hear, ba 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 ba? That's a pneumatic wrench with power to unlock that crazy rusted nut on your ruah, pneuma, the same in different languages. When Jesus is meeting with Nicodemus, one of the most important, smartest, wealthiest people in all of Israel. He sits on the Supreme Court of Israel. But he's heard about Jesus and he's intrigued. So the Gospel of John says he went at night. Because what do you do if you don't want anyone to see you? You go to church at night late. And so he goes and Jesus doesn't yell at him. Jesus enters into a conversation. You can read about it in John chapter 3. And Jesus says to Nicodemus, you know all this stuff. You are a teacher of all Israel. You've got a PhD in Hebrew, Greek, and theology. You know it all. But you need to be born of the Spirit. You need to be born of Ruah. You need to be born of Pneuma. You need your heart to be changed so that you can see what God is doing. Because you know all about God, but you don't know God. Once again, Jesus pulling these images from Ezekiel and bringing them forward. I don't know about you, but I need a ruah sometimes. I need pneuma. I need my heart to be broken through the cynicism, the frustration, the hopelessness. And I need God to remind me, it's my world. You're my son. This is my ministry. And you are blessed and privileged to be along for the ride. So listen to me. Care the way I care. Teach the way I teach. Live the way I live. And I will give you all those joys and all that meaning and all that purpose that you want. Seek first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added to you. Well, there's a whole bunch of chapters in Ezekiel that I skipped over. I would encourage you to read them. They're strange and weird. Some of them speak messages to global powers, Egypt, and what we now know as Iran and Iraq and other countries. So this is a God of the whole world, not just a God of Jerusalem, not just a God of Naperville, a God of the whole world. But he's a God of the personal. He speaks to me in my place of need. He speaks to you in whatever story you walked in with, God's story breaks in. I'm going to let you just take a couple minutes right now and just share something with somebody next to you. Maybe it's, if I could pray any one thing and have it answered, here's what I'd pray. If you feel comfortable doing that, if there's some learning that you've had out of today's message or the last couple weeks, share that. maybe share a question that you have. If you could ask God anything right now, not just a request, but a why question, what would that why question be? Because that too is a prayer. Share that with somebody next to you. We'll take just a couple minutes for that moment of reflection.
The hand of the Lord was upon me. He brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley. He asked me, "Son of man, can these bones live?" I said, "O sovereign Lord, you alone know." Then he said to me, "Prophesy to these bones and say to them, 'Dry bones, hear the voice of the Lord. I will make breath into you and you will come to life.' Then you will know that I am the Lord." So I prophesied as I was commanded, and as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together. And tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them. But there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, "Prophesy to the breath and say to it, 'Come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe into these slain that they may live.'" So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them. They came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army.
Is near. On earth, God's at work.
God of hope, when despair fills our hearts because our world resembles Israel, wrought with anger, discord, and unrest, deliver us from the depths of our darkness.
Let your face shine. Let your voice be heard, so that we may dwell in your presence. Grace, mercy, and peace. Shine your light, O God.
Exalt the shepherd. Bow, tyrants, in his presence. Trampled sheep, rise up.
God of mercy, when our pain resembles the sheep of Israel, lost, alone, downtrodden, and injured, shepherd us together again.
Build us up. Build a community that knows your ways, so that we may follow in your presence, grace, mercy, and peace. Lead us, O God.
Breathe, O breath of God.
Nations of corpses, lost hope, what can inspire? His breath, Ruah, life.
Giver of life, when our bones lie in the valley that resembles Israel, dry, brittle, and decayed, breathe your goodness into our bodies.
Breath of heaven. hearts beat only for you. Raise us up to your presence, grace, mercy, peace, and love. Lord of all, hear our prayer.
Breathe the breath of God. Breathe the breath of God. We call out to dry bones, come alive, come alive. We call out to dead hearts, come alive, come alive. Up out of the ashes, let us see an army rise. We call out to dry bones, come alive. We call out to dry bones.
We all